Yes, exactly. We're starting chapter 4, page 106.
Very good.
And I'm recording.
Okay.
Okay, a little meditation.
Yes.
Do we have an order
Yeah. Usually we take my order, but I don't want to impose any order to anyone.
Well, you just read it
But
off and
yeah. Okay, so I see clockwise John, Robert, me, and then you, Geoffrey, and then Andrea.
Okay.
Okay. All right, here we go. 4 minutes, 5 minutes, what were we like?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
chapter 4, the sacrifice, the triune path, and the Lord of the sacrifice. The law of sacrifice is the common divine action that was thrown out into the world in its beginning as a symbol of the solidarity of the universe. It is by the attraction of this law that a divinizing principle, a saving power, descends to limit and correct, and gradually to eliminate the errors of an egotistic and self-divided creation. This descent, the sacrifice of the Purusha, the divine soul, submitting itself to force and matter so that it may inform and illuminate them, is the seed of redemption of this world of inconscience and ignorance. For with sacrifice as their companion, says the Gita, the All-Father created these peoples. The acceptance of the law of sacrifice is a practical recognition by the ego that it is neither alone in the world nor chief in the world. It is its admission that even in this much fragmented existence, there is beyond itself and behind that which is not its own egoistic person, something greater and completer, a diviner all, which demands from it subordination and service. Indeed, somebody else is going to have to read.
Okay, I can take over. Indeed, sacrifice is imposed and, where need be, compelled by the universal world force, it takes it even from those who do not consciously recognize the law. Inevitably, because this is the intrinsic nature of things. Our ignorance or our false egoistic view of life can make no difference to this eternal bedrock truth of nature. For this is the truth in nature, that this ego, which thinks itself a separate independent being and claims to live for itself, is not and cannot be independent, nor separate, nor can it live to itself, and even if it would, but rather all are linked together by a secret oneness. Each existence is continually giving our pure force from its stock, out of its mental receipts from nature, or its vital and physical assets and acquisitions and belongings. A stream goes to all that is around it. And always again, it receives something from its environment gratis or in return for its voluntary or involuntary tribute. For it is only by this giving and receiving that it can effect its own growth, while at the same time it helps the sum of things. At length, though at first slowly and partially, we learn to make the conscious sacrifice. Even in the end, we take joy to give ourselves and what we envisage as belonging to us in a spirit of love and devotion to that which appears for the moment other than ourselves and is certainly other than our limited personalities. The sacrifice and the divine return for our sacrifice then become a gladly accepted means towards our last perfection, for it is recognized now as the road to the fulfillment in us of the eternal purpose. Is it all right, John Robert? Are you okay?
Shall I continue?
Yeah, Geoffrey, yeah.
But most often the sacrifice is done unconsciously, egoistically, and without knowledge or acceptance of the true meaning of the great world rite. It is so that the vast majority of earth creatures do it. And when it is so done, the individual derives only a mechanical minimum of natural, inevitable profit, achieves by it only a slow, painful progress, limited and tortured by the smallness and suffering of the ego. Only when the heart, the will, and the mind of knowledge associate themselves with the law and gladly follow it, can there come the deep joy and happy fruitfulness of divine sacrifice. The mind's knowledge of the law and the heart's gladness in it culminate in the perception that it is to our own self and spirit and the one self and spirit of all that we give. And this is true even when our self-offering is still to our fellow creatures or to lesser powers and principles, and not yet to the Supreme. Not for the sake of the wife, says Yajnavalkya in the Upanishad, but for the sake of the self is the wife dear to us. This is the lower sense of the individual self. This in the lower sense of the individual self is the hard fact behind the colored and passionate professions of egoistic love. But in a higher sense, it is the inner significance of that love too, which is not egoistic, but divine. All true love and all sacrifice are in their essence nature's contradiction of the primary egoism and its separative error. It is her attempt to turn from a necessary first fragmentation towards a recovered oneness. All unity between creatures is in its essence a self-finding, a fusion with that from which we have separated, a discovery of oneself in others.
But it is only a divine love and unity that can possess in the light what the human forms of these things seek for in the darkness. For the true unity is not merely an association, an agglomeration, like that of physical cells joined by a life of common interests. It is not even an emotional understanding, sympathy, solidarity, or close drawing together. Only then are we really unified with those separated from us by the divisions of nature, when we annul the division and find ourselves in that which seemed to us not ourselves. Association is a vital and physical unity. Its sacrifice is that of mutual aid and concessions. Nearness, sympathy, solidarity create a mental, moral, and emotional unity. Theirs is a sacrifice of mutual support and mutual gratifications. But the true unity is spiritual. Its sacrifice is a mutual self-giving, an interfusion of our inner substance. The law of sacrifice, which travels in nature towards its culmination in this complete and unreserved self-giving. It awakens the consciousness of one common self in the giver and the object of the sacrifice. This culmination of sacrifice is the height even of human love and devotion when it tries to become divine. For there too, the highest peak of love points into a heaven of complete mutual self-giving. Its summit is the rapturous fusing of two souls into one.
This profounder idea of the worldwide law is at the heart of the teaching about works given in the Gita. A spiritual union with the highest by sacrifice, an unreserved self-giving to the eternal, is the core of its doctrine. The vulgar conception of sacrifice is an act of painful self-immolation, austere self-mortification, difficult self-effacement. This kind of sacrifice may go even as far as self-mutilation and self-torture. These things may be temporarily necessary in man's hard endeavor to exceed his natural self. If the egoism in his nature is violent and obstinate, it has to be met sometimes by an answering strong internal repression and counterbalancing violence. But the Gita discourages any excessive violence done to oneself, for the self within is really the Godhead evolving. It is Krishna. It is the divine. It has not to be troubled and tortured as the titans of the world trouble and torture it, but to be increased, fostered, cherished, luminously opened to a divine light and strength and joy and wideness. It is not oneself, but the band of the spirit's inner enemies that we have to discourage, dispel, slay upon the altar of the growth of the spirit. These can be ruthlessly excised, whose names are desire, wrath, inequality, greed, attachment to outward pleasures and pains, the cohort of usurping demons that are the cause of the soul's errors and sufferings. These should be regarded not as part of oneself, but as intruders and perverters of ourselves' real and diviner nature. These have to be sacrificed in the harsher sense of the world, whatever pain in going they may throw by reflection on the consciousness of the seeker.
May I pause a moment here because as usual, here is a lot of stuff in here and I'm struggling to follow a bit. Yeah. In fact, here now he's coming to the point that I was wondering all the time. This word sacrifice, I don't like it, because when I think it's sacrifice, I think it's a sacrifice, human sacrifice, sacrifice of animals. Yeah, this, you know, this. Maybe it's me that has been conditioned by a culture that thinks that the word sacrifice with this and has this imagery, violent imagery. So, I struggle a bit to identify a sacrifice with self-giving. I don't know. I get what he might mean by self-giving to the divine, but why must we call it sacrifice? And then there is also another thing at the beginning where he speaks of an error. Now I don't find it again. It is by attraction law, divinizing principle, a saving power descends to limit and correct gradually to limit the errors of an egoistic and self-divided creation. But if this creation is the creation of a divine being, well, how can there be an error? So it seems to me a bit in contradiction. I'm getting in a infinite loop, logical loop here. I don't know, maybe you have some thoughts about that.
Well, remember that the error arrives because the divine is plunging into the inconscient. And then the mind develops and it sees everything as separate. It's not that it was created that way, but it was the unavoidable result of creation. So there's the error in, because we cannot perceive our unity, because we are in these separate bodies with seemingly separate minds. Right? So that's the whole work, to sacrifice the separation. And he actually addresses that whole thing that you just mentioned, Marco, that negative association. You just read that whole thing where he debates that as not desirable. That's not the way it is meant.
Yeah. Here he makes this point, but then why using this word? Let's use another word. Just let's call it self-giving.
So, I mean, we've been reading the Vedas, and the Vedas we've written pretty well, one of the earliest texts written about any of these things. And in the Vedas, the sacrifice is the way he talks about it, not the way Western traditions have demonized the word. So I think the reason he uses sacrifice, because it's deeply, deeply rooted into the Vedas, which is the original text behind these ideas. It's us who has to get rid of these other associations. And I don't know, if I think about it, you know, so there is a tradition of sort of destruction of an individual as a sacrifice. But I don't know, even in this tradition, the self-giving is, in some sense, hazardous, right? I mean, it has these huge benefits, but so I think one doesn't want to take away the sense of hazard that goes with the idea of sacrifice, even though the way it's described here is a joyous but it's still something, you know, it means giving up the whole self, which is something that one doesn't do lightly. So therefore, the heavier side of the term sacrifice, I think, needs to stay. And it's another reason for keeping it. As for the error, I think Andrea has it, you know, exactly right. The it's about the, not exactly the mind, right? Because although one could argue that the mind always sees things in parts instead of wholes, but the mind is capable of seeing things in wholes. So the terminology uses this egoistic, which has this tendency to, the problem with the ego is not that it sees things in parts, it's that it attached itself to this seeing things in parts. So it can't pull away from seeing things in parts because it holds on to the part as if it were the whole. And so it's not so much, so that's why it's an egoistic thing rather than a mental thing, right? Because the mentality is capable of seeing things in broader terms, but the ego gets attached to things. And that's the error, but it's not a divine error, it's our error.
Yeah, that's how I don't read it. I read it, I don't, maybe it's a matter of grammar here. It is by the attraction of this law that a divinizing principle, so it's not about us, a saving power descends to limit and correct and gradually to eliminate the errors of an egoistic and self-divided creation. So he's speaking of a creation. It's not about us. So it's an error of the creation, which was already there before the existence of the human being or life on Earth. I read it in that way. Mm. So, and this brings me into because he always, in other parts, he says there this truth knowledge of the supermind is always perfect and there is no error. There is perfectly knowledge by identity and perfect seeing of everything. Now, it seems that there is a sort of divinity who, well, one time at least has made a big mistake and now has to correct it. No, certainly he doesn't mean that by in this sense, but that's what I get by this sentence. And yeah, okay, that's more a philosophical aspect that might not be so important. But from the practical point of view, the sacrifice, yes, I think the sacrifice is more, triggers in me something that is more due to my culture, my Western culture. Yeah, certainly in the Veda, it has a completely different meaning. Yeah.
It reminds me how in Savitri, Sri Aurobindo actually calls about the Holocaust of the Divine Mother.
Yeah.
When she throws herself into creation, she abandons, in a way, her divinity. She becomes nature. And that's where the error comes in. She is willing to do that, to go into the dark, in the inconscient, so that eventually we can have a conscious manifestation. Because without the manifestation, there's nothing.
Or maybe he's speaking to us on a level that we can understand it better on the mental level. On the mental level, you see errors. On a higher level, there are no errors at all. Everything has a meaning and a place in the universe. So what to us seems to be an error is a normal state of affairs. Oh, okay, but that's enough for
something here too. One help, I think, with sacrifice, the word sacrifice, is to look at its root. So the root is from Latin, and it means to make sacred.
Yeah.
So to sacrifice is to make something sacred.
Yeah.
And so that's one help in just dealing with the word and the associations that you were talking about, Marco, that are around it in our secular understanding of things, which doesn't pay any attention to the sacred, doesn't basically denies it or discounts it.
Yeah.
And on the other question, the manifestation is a, according to the Life Divine, it's a divine principle of self-limitation. So it's part of the power and freedom of the divine to self-limit, which is not an error. It's not a mistake, it's not an error. And Sri Aurobindo says the purpose of it is the adventure. And if you're gonna have adventure, you have to have challenges and all kinds of things to make right, you know? The hero has to make things right from the errors. But so from our point of view, all the catastrophes that are going on and have been going on for millennia in human history are errors. But as you were saying, Marco, from the divine point of view, it's the adventure.
Yeah, this is a good point, yeah.
So I think you're right. It's the point of view where everything is that. Everything is that, including the torture and all the rest of it. Everything is that. But from our point of view of separation, you know, it's an abomination.
Yeah.
And so that's part of our adventure of learning.
Yeah, thank you, Robert. This was a very good point, yes. This adventure of joy and consciousness. And the separation. And if we would know everything already, it would be a bit boring. No? So to make it an adventure, you make yourself ignorant, so you don't know any. That's just like a play, the divine lila,
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the whole thing is about the divine becoming conscious of itself, right? And that's what we are doing. We are that part of the divine that is becoming conscious of itself. And for that journey, you need separation to begin with. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any.
So it's my turn, or am I right? Yes, okay. But the true essence of sacrifice is not self-immolation. So here we are. It is self-giving. Its object not self-effacement, but self-fulfillment. Its method not self-mortification, but a greater life, not self-mutilation, but a transformation of our natural human parts into divine members, not self-torture, but a passage from a lesser satisfaction to a greater ananda. There is only one thing painful in the beginning to a raw or turbid part of the surface nature. It is the indispensable discipline demanded, the denial necessary for the merging of the incomplete ego. But for that there can be a speedy and enormous compensation in the discovery of a real greater or ultimate completeness in others, in all things, in the cosmic oneness, in the freedom of the transcendent self and spirit, in the rapture of the touch of the divine. Our sacrifice is not a giving without any return or any fruitful acceptance from the other side. It is an interchange between the embodied soul and conscious nature in us and the eternal spirit. For even though no return is demanded, yet there is the knowledge deep within us that a marvelous return is inevitable. The soul knows that it does not give itself to God in vain. Claiming nothing, it yet receives the infinite riches of the divine power and presence.
Last, there is to be considered the recipient of the sacrifice and the manner of the sacrifice. The sacrifice may be offered to others, or it may be offered to divine powers. It may be offered to the cosmic all, or it may be offered to the transcendent supreme. The worship given may take any shape from the dedication of a leaf or flower, a cup of water, a handful of rice, a loaf of bread, to consecration of all that we possess and the submission of all that we are. Whoever the recipient, whatever the gift, it is the supreme, the eternal in things, who receives and accepts it, even if it be rejected or ignored by the immediate recipient. For the supreme who transcends the universe is yet here too, however veiled, in us and in the world and in its happenings. He is there as the omniscient witness and receiver of all our works and their secret master. All our actions, all our efforts, even our sins and stumblings and sufferings and struggles, are obscurely or consciously known to us and seen or else unknown, and in a disguise governed in their last resort by the One. All is turned towards Him in His numberless forms and offered through them to the single omnipresence. In whatever form and with whatever spirit we approach Him, in that form and with that spirit, He receives the sacrifice.
So I find this last line very interesting. In whatever form and with whatever spirit we approach Him, in that form and with that spirit, he receives the sacrifice. So there seems to be that the individual creates its own limitation to how it is received by that. That's how I read this.
Yeah, you know, in the stories of near-death experiences, people experience the light on the other side in pretty much in terms of their own cultural understanding of things.
Right.
So I think that's similar to what Sri Aurobindo is saying here.
Mm-hmm. And the fruit also of the sacrifice of works varies according to the work, according to the intention in the work, and according to the spirit that is behind the intention. But all other sacrifices are partial, egoistic, mixed, temporal, incomplete. Even those offered to the highest powers or principles keep this character. The result too is partial, limited, temporal, mixed in its reactions, effective only for a minor or intermediate purpose. The one entirely acceptable sacrifice is a last and highest and uttermost self-giving. It is that surrender made face to face with devotion and knowledge, freely and without any reserve to the one who is at once our immanent self, the environing constituent of all, the supreme reality beyond this or any manifestation, and secretly all these together, concealed everywhere, the immanent transcendence. For to the soul that wholly gives itself to him, God also gives himself altogether. Only the one who offers his whole nature finds the self. Only the one who can give everything enjoys the divine all everywhere. Only a supreme self-abandonment attains to the supreme. Only the sublimation by sacrifice of all that we are can enable us to embody the highest and live here in the immanent consciousness of the transcendent spirit.
There's a break here in the text. Do we want to stop, Jeffrey?
Yeah, so I was going to say, just for the previous discussion we had about sacrifice and that last line about in whatever form, whatever spirit we approach him in that form and with that spirit he receives the sacrifice. I'm reminded of the text from the Vedas where it is also... So Agni who receives the sacrifice, but Agni also gives the sacrifice. So the gods are involved in and take upon themselves the sacrifice. So it's not just that they are receptive, but they are also part of the process of giving the sacrifice. So and the other thing I was going to say about this, I can remember what I was going to say. Oh, is this idea of the imminent transcendence, which seems like a contradiction, right? So I find that very interesting. And it's one of the things that I struggle with personally, because I tend to cleave to the imminent and not to the transcendent. So I'm a bit, I get the idea of it, but I'm not entirely comfortable with it, right?
So what do you think is the imminent?
But where is this? We say imminent transcendence.
It's about 6-7 lines up from the bottom of that last paragraph.
The one who offers the whole nature thinks and gives him. The imminent transcendence. Yeah, that's interesting.
One of the things that's sort of part of my reading of Deleuze, because Deleuze is a philosopher who kind of, you know, there are many philosophers who are either immanent or transcendent, but Deleuze kind of slips between them. And he declares his philosophy as being immanent, but there's also a transcendent side to it. So it's one of these, so it's kind of interesting, yeah.
But does he not explain it in the last lines where he says, the highest and live here in the immanent consciousness of the transcendent spirit? Just the last line. So perhaps it's in this sense that we have to interpret this. I don't know, but
I mean, that's the whole journey, right? From the transcendent to the immanent, to from that to us. And from us to that.
Yeah, Sri Aurobindo here is necessarily speaking in the limitations of mental language, which is dualistic. So we have transcendent and immanent being opposites, or, you know, two entirely different things. But it's worth keeping in mind that that's what we're stuck in here. We're sort of stuck in the duality of mental language, which doesn't capture the whole truth of things, doesn't capture the unity of duality. Should we go on?
Okay. This, in short, is the demand made on us that we should turn our whole life into a conscious sacrifice. Every moment and every movement of our being is to be resolved into a continuous and devoted self-giving to the eternal. All our actions, not less the smallest and most ordinary and trifling, than the greatest and most uncommon and noble, must be performed as consecrated acts. Our individualized nature must live in the single consciousness of an inner and outer movement dedicated to something that is beyond us and greater than our ego. No matter what the gift and to whom it is presented by us, there must be a consciousness in the act that we are presenting it to the one divine being and all beings. Our commonest and most grossly material actions must assume this sublimated character. When we eat, we should be conscious that we are giving our food to that presence in us. It must be a sacred offering in the temple, and the sense of a mere physical need or self-gratification must pass away from us. This is where the tall order comes in. In any great labor, in any high discipline, in any difficult or noble enterprise, whether undertaken for ourselves, for others, or for the race, it will no longer be possible to stop short at the idea of the race, of ourselves, or of others. The thing we are doing must be consciously offered as a sacrifice of works, not to these, but either through them or directly to the one Godhead. Hang on for a second. Let's see if I can find where I was.
I
The thing we are doing must be consciously offered as a sacrifice of works, not to these, but either through them or directly to the one Godhead. The divine inhabitant who was hidden by these figures must be no longer hidden, but ever present to our soul, our mind, our sense. The workings and results of our acts must be put in the hands of that one in the feeling that that presence is the infinite and most high, by whom alone our labor and our aspiration are possible. For in his being all takes place. For him all labor and aspiration are taken from us by nature and offered on his altar. Even in those things in which nature is herself very plainly the worker and we only the witnesses of her working and its containers and supporters, there should be the same constant memory and insistent consciousness of a work and of its divine master. Our very inspiration and respiration, our very heartbeats can and must be made conscious in us as the living rhythm of the universal sacrifice.
It is clear that a conception of this kind and its effective practice must carry in them three results that are of a central importance for our spiritual ideal. It is evident to begin with that even if such a discipline is begun without devotion, it leads straight and inevitably towards the highest devotion possible. For it must deepen naturally into the completest adoration imaginable, the most profound God love. There is bound up with it a growing sense of the divine in all things, a deepening communion with the divine in all our thought, will, and action, and at every moment of our lives, a more and more moved consecration to the divine of the totality of our being. Now, these implications of the yoga of works are also of the very essence of an integral and absolute bhakti. Seeker who puts them into living practice makes in himself continually a constant, active, and effective representation of the very spirit of self-devotion. And it is inevitable that out of it there should emerge the most engrossing worship of the highest to whom is given this service. An absorbing love for the divine presence to whom he feels an always more intimate closeness grows upon the consecrated worker. And with it is born, or in it is contained, a universal love too for all these beings, living forms and creatures that are habitations of the divine. Not the brief, restless, grasping emotions of division, but the settled, selfless love that is the deeper vibration of oneness. In all, the seeker begins to meet the one object of his adoration and service. The way of works turns by this road of sacrifice to meet the path of devotion. It can be itself a devotion as complete, as absorbing, as integral, as any the desire of the heart can ask for or the passion of the mind can imagine.
Next, the practice of this yoga demands a constant inward remembrance of the one central liberating knowledge and a constant active externalizing of it in works. Next, the practice of this yoga demands a constant inward remembrance of the one central liberating knowledge and a constant active externalizing of it in works comes in to intensify the remembrance. In all is the one self, the one divine is all. All are in the divine. All are the divine, and there is nothing else in the universe. This thought or this face is the whole background until it becomes the whole substance of the consciousness of the worker. A memory, a self-dynamizing meditation of this kind, must and does in its end turn into a profound and uninterrupted vision and a vivid and all-embracing consciousness of that which we so powerfully remember or on which we so constantly meditate. For it compels a constant reference at each moment to the origin of all being and will and action. There is at once an embracing and exceeding of all particular forms and appearances in that which is their cause and upholder. This way cannot go to its end without a seeing vivid and vital, as concrete in its way as physical sight, of the works of the universal spirit everywhere. On its summits it rises into a constant living and thinking and willing and acting, in the presence of the supramental, the transcendent. Whatever we see and hear, whatever we touch and sense, all of which we are conscious has to be known and felt by us as that which we worship and serve. All has to be turned into an image of the divinity, perceived as a dwelling place of his Godhead, enveloped with the eternal omnipresence. In its close, if not long before it, this way of works turns by communion with the divine presence, will, and force into a way of knowledge more complete and integral than any the mere creature intelligence can construct or the search of the intellect can discover.
Lastly, the practice of this yoga of sacrifice compels us to renounce all the inner supports of egoism, casting them out of our mind and will and actions, and to eliminate its seed, its presence, its influence out of our nature. All must be done for the divine. All must be directed towards the divine. Nothing must be attempted for ourselves as a separate existence. Nothing done for others, whether neighbors, friends, family, country, or mankind, or other creatures, merely because they are connected with our personal life and thought and sentiment, or because the ego takes a preferential interest in their welfare. This way of doing and seeing all works and all life become only a daily dynamic worship and service of the divine in the unbounded temple of his own vast cosmic existence. Life becomes more and more the sacrifice of the eternal in the individual, constantly self-offered to the eternal transcendence. It is offered in the wide sacrificial ground of the field of the eternal cosmic spirit, and the force too that offers it is the eternal force, the omnipresent mother. Therefore is this way a way of union and communion by acts and by the spirit and knowledge in the act, as complete and integral as our Godward can hope for, or our soul strength execute.
So I'd like to address the thing that I really miss, particularly in this paragraph, but in Sri Aurobindo, is the need, especially for those of us in the West with our neurotic social structures and personal structures, to make sure that we don't overlook places in us that need healing. That's all I want to say about that.
Would you say more about it?
I'll just be personal. So for me personally, if I only turn or try to turn everything to the divine, I may well overlook deeper needs in my subconscious being that need attention. As a child, I was neglected and separated, and it created a huge internal, unseen, unprocessed suffering. It's taken me very, 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 very long time. And I'm not finding much in Mother and Sri Aurobindo, especially not in Sri Aurobindo, addressing that necessity to deal with our own shadow material.
That's clear, thank you. And I actually agree, so.
The way I describe it often, I cannot offer what I don't own. I can't sacrifice, I can't give away what I'm not fully aware of. So if I need to own it, which means I have to go in there and discover the whole thing and be with it, and hold it, own it lovingly. So then I have a gift to offer.
Well, it's difficult to relate to these things because I think everyone has a personal story. So I can't relate in any way to your story, and I'm even not sure that it is sometimes difficult to speak of the same thing. Because when I say something, you might mean something completely different and so on. But as far as go to my experience, when there is this offering, it is not an overlooking, quite the contrary. And that's, for me, it's the problem, the big problem. When there's the offering, it is also a disclosing of our darkest parts, which come up, which are brought to the surface. And it is a process which paradoxically is a process of light, which enlightens our darkest parts and presents these parts also to us. But by offering these things, we become aware of these things. And I realize that I'm not able, me as ego, as person, to deal with it. At the end of the story, I still have to offer it, because if I don't offer it and I try to deal myself with my dark side, so to speak, or with my traumas, or with my what did you say, places in us which require healing. I like this very much. But at the end of the story, I see that the healing comes never from me. From me, there must be an opening, as this self-giving, a sincerity. And the rest, it is the mother or the divine, or however you want to call it, which makes the real world work. I myself am not able to do it. I'm not able to deal with it. But I become very, very aware of all that there is down there in the subconscious. And sometimes I have the opposite problem. I would say, please, can you take that, just make you this work? Why do you need to show me all this? Yeah, but probably it doesn't work like that. We have to become aware of that.
Shall I continue?
I'd just like to say thank you to both of you for sharing this, what you had to say about this.
Yeah, I liked what you said, Marco. Although I do feel the same kind of issues, some of the same kind of issues anyway, that Andrea was talking about. But maybe it's, you know, I remember thinking a few days ago, reading something else of Aurobindo's, and I was thinking, was he bullied as a child? You know, because he talks about the dark side of things. So he had to, you know, and we were talking about it, Andrea, about the fact that, you know, the reason we're involved in this kind of work is because we've been through the dregs and the darker stuff. And it, in a way, it forges the person who's able to open up in these ways, right? So if you didn't go through that, you don't get the openness that comes from the other end of it either. You know, I don't know much about Sri Aurobindo's early life, but one assumes that he must have gone through some of this darker issues in his early life. But, you know, I don't know much about that.
He was separated from his family. I think he was 7 when his father sent him to England to live with a family that I don't know how much they even know them, but Sri Aurobindo was hungry as a child in England and lonely. He was ripped away from his culture. And then, of course, he was brilliant, so he ended up in Cambridge and did all of that. But I have often wondered about that part because I don't hear about it.
He was actually sent to a convent school in the foothills of the Himalayas when he was 5.
Oh.
So he was separated from his family early by his father. He was sent there by his father because his father was in love with English culture. He had been trained there. And Sri Aurobindo also says about his youth that when he was a young person, he was a liar. And he said at some point he decided he didn't like that. He didn't like being a liar. And so he stopped being a liar. But in his letters, he'll sometimes talk about the dark that he went through in his yoga. And you can see it in Savitri, where he describes the dark, the lower vital in Ashwapati's yoga in the first half of Savitri. And actually, Mother does talk about the dealing with the shadow, and that whole part. I think they call it purification. So before the soul is forward enough to offer, as Andrea was saying, to own and offer, a lot of stuff has to be gotten out of the way. And there's something called I've forgotten the name of it now, spiritual bypassing, which I think a lot of us, certainly I've been involved in, where you try to jump right to the happy parts without dealing with the dark parts. And of course, it doesn't work very good. But yeah, if you look for it, and I don't know so much in Srivana's writings where he's specifically talking about himself. I mean, he does talk about his time in jail. But in Mother's works, if you're just paying attention, when you read her works, you'll find the shadow. She'll talk about the shadow and the shadow work.
So maybe it has to do with how one reads the text. So I'm looking back here at this thing. All must be done for the divine. All must be directed towards the divine. So if it really is all, then it's as much the shadow stuff as the light stuff, right? But one tends to read that kind of a phrase out of a Christian kind of ethos, where it's all focused on the light. But I think maybe it's not all focused on the light is what we're sort of getting at, is that it is we have to, you know, it's one of these things of taking the blinkers off and reading these things the way they were intended to be read, rather than, anyway, maybe I'm being silly, but yeah.
Yeah, well, Asapati's yoga didn't get where he wanted to go until he went through the dark.
Right.
He had those horrible cantos that he had to go through, and they're really gruesome.
Yeah, although, again, the abstract dark is very different from the real dark, as it were. You know, I mean, when one talks about the dark, one has these images, you know, of storied evil, you know, but the dark in ourselves isn't evil in that way. It's not. Anyway, I maybe again, I'm just struggling with these issues, I guess.
But it's like the sacrifice with me. It's just a culture that we associate to words also an inner emotional feeling. Yeah? When someone speaks of sacrifice, because it came to my mind now that I remember that when I was a child, I had to make a special work in school about the human sacrifice of the Maya. Yeah? Mm-hmm. About the Maya. I don't know if it's true, this, but it's at least that's what they told us in school. I'm not an historian. And this made me a lot of impression. I said, why do they make these human sacrifices and then also babies and then animals? And this remains in the subconscious of our cultural subconscious. And when we read them, and yeah, it's normal, I think, but we have to become aware of this. And many things that we read here now probably are not exactly how he meant it as it appears to us. And it becomes clear only when we have this direct contact experience of these things. And that's why I like to reread always these things. Because every time that I reread it, I read something completely different than the previous reading. So it's always also very, it's like a film that is never the same film, a movie.
So I kind of feel a bit saturated.
So there's a really, really small paragraph till okay. The end of a break. So let me finish that one.
Yeah.
And okay. I'm feeling the same way. It has all the power of a way of works integral and absolute. But because of its law of sacrifice and self-giving to the divine self and master, it is accompanied on its one side by the whole power of the path of love, and on the other side by the whole power of the path of knowledge. At its end, all these three divine powers work together, fused, united, completed, perfected by each other.
What is the third power? So power of the path of love or the path of knowledge? Which is the third?
And path of works.
Love, sacrifice.
Works, yeah.
Works, yeah, of course.
Works.
Okay. Knowledge, path, love, knowledge, work. Okay, thank you.
Yes, it's a good place to call it a day.
Yeah, great. Oh, we made a lot, I think. We proceeded. Huh? We read a good deal.
Because it's a long chapter, and I just feel like it's enough for me today, and I'll be fresh next time for the next bit. But,
I agree.
Great, okay.
Pretty, a lot, pretty intense. Okay, shall I do the ding?
Ding, ding. Thank you to all.
Thank you, everybody.
Can you hear the rain on my house?
Yep, it is. In the background.
It's coming down. See you next time.
Good to be with you all. Bye-bye.